and Brandon versus NLH.
May it please the court. This action was originally instituted under the Labor Management Relations Act by the plaintiffs as separate causes of action against both their union and their employer. They settled the cause of action with their union, and subsequently their employer filed a motion for summary judgment claiming that the plaintiffs could provide no proof that the union breached its duty of fair representation. Obviously, under the case law that has come down from Baca versus Sipes, proof has to be provided both that the union breached its duty of fair representation and that the employer breached its contract in order for the plaintiff to recover. Obviously, the motion for summary judgment issues are generally whether there are any material facts in dispute and whether there is a genuine issue, that is, whether a reasonable jury could find that the union was arbitrary or perfunctory in failing to file or prosecute the grievances on behalf of the plaintiffs in this matter. The action for Neal is based on the fact that the employer had a policy of calling in to report illnesses. Neal did so on two consecutive days. The employer claimed he did not do so. The union steward discovered that there was a taped call-in by Neal for those 2 days. He reported it to the employer. The employer refused to rescind the termination, and the union steward did not file a grievance.
Mr. Baer, did either of the plaintiffs meet with his foreman within 5 days as required by the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, I submit that they did, because Neal was fired by his foreman when he returned after the second day of illness. Brandon was also fired by his foreman when he returned to work the next morning after his previous night's work. So I think that constitutes a meeting.
I have a problem with the structure of this case. Why the union is no longer a party. So you settled with the union. The company is in the position of having to argue that the union provided fair representation. Ordinarily, the company would not know everything that the union did, what the discharged worker, the disciplined worker said to the union steward, what the union people discussed. I think it's very odd to have one of these hybrid cases without the union being a party and arguing that its representation was
The case law provides that you can sue either party, but you have to make proof that they both committed a wrong.
I'm having a hard time, and I don't know if there are cases where the union hasn't been a party to a claim of failure to fairly represent.
Well, for economic reasons, the plaintiffs settled with the union that I don't think that created made the case any different than it would have been if the union had been in it.
I mean, are you aware of cases under these hybrid type of cases where the union is no longer a party?
I don't recall a citation, but in my research, I ran across one case in which they said, and I think there was just a suit filed against either the employer or the union, and the court said you still have to prove that both a breach of contract and a breach of the duty of fair representation, but you can just sue one party if that's your choice.
Okay.
But you have to make the same proof to recover against both of them, even if they're in the same case. The situation with Brandon was that he was scheduled to work until 10 o'clock at night, and again at 6 a.m. the next morning. He was ordered to work at 9:45 the night before. He didn't do so. He left when his shift ended, and then he was terminated the next day. Now, the sub-issue in this is whether or not the employer has a right to mandatorily require overtime when it has partially negotiated overtime by having a provision in the contract that it can have employees work 3 10-hour days when it is providing for commercial work. And also, when you juxtapose that against 29 USC 158, which provides that there's a duty on both the employer and the union to mutually bargain with respect to any employment issues. And there's no evidence in this case that the employer sought to bargain that. So
why didn't the employees file their request in a timely manner?
Well, they requested the union steward to file grievances on their behalf. And it's our position that it's a fiduciary duty of the union steward as exclusive representative to take that action.
Without them filing a request in writing?
Right. I think the request can be made orally.
Is that in the union contract? Did you look it up?
No, I don't know if that's in the union contract. There's no...
In other words, it's your theory that the union has an obligation to file a grievance, even though they see no merit to it.
Oh, not in that instance. There's no question. In that instance, there don't. But there's never been a determination made by the union in this case that these terminations were...
Well, every disciplined employee then has is entitled to a hearing? To a grievance procedure?
No, the union can make a determination whether or not the grievance has merit, but they didn't make that determination in this case.
Well, how would they make it if they didn't have a request according to their own rules?
Well, they had a request by their union members, Neil and Brandon.
Orally, you say?
Right.
And in a timely fashion.
And in a timely fashion.
Right.
Now, there's a tripartite standard for determining, I guess that my end's my...
You're into your rebuttal time.
Okay. All right. The issue is whether or not the union was arbitrary or perfunctory in carrying out its representation in this case, and we submitted this, and I'll... reserve whatever time I have for rebuttal.
Thank you. All right, counsel.
Good morning, members of the panel, and may it please the court. I believe and listening to the comments earlier, that this really is a unique case where the employer is arguing that the union did its job. But as you understand, that the state of the law for the plaintiff is they must show both that the union breached its duty of fair representation and to prevail that the employer breached the agreement. From our perspective, for Newspaper Holdings, we believe, quite frankly, in arguing the district court got it right in granting summary judgment. There was presented on behalf of Plaintiff Neal only the issue of the union's duty of fair representation. As to Plaintiff Brandon, the employer presented the union duty of fair representation and the second prong that there was no breach of the collective bargaining agreement based on this working overtime question. The district court did not rule on Brandon's cases to the employer's breach of contract issue because it had already found there was no union duty breach, so it felt it did not have to get there. I would just mention that this court, if you consider the issue de novo, as you have the right, that the case of the contract breach is not there, and I would cite the Trinka versus Local Union 688 that you just have an argument. You don't really even have a colorable claim. In fact, the record below, the employer presented expert testimony as to the rights of the employer to require overtime where the contract is silent as it is, and people forget, or the record shows that Brandon was working his regularly shifts, so shifts he gets by exercising his seniority rights under the collective bargaining agreements. Also, would point out specifically here in 2001, the McLeod versus Aero Marine Transport case by this court covers several of the points. Neal, in fact, did not ever file a grievance. Brandon, through his attorney, filed one. I believe 7 weeks after his termination. Therefore, as to Neal, you look at McLeod, not filing a grievance would be fatal to the employee. Also, you have to look at this issue of what the employees told the union. At most, by the record, they just told the union or the union steward, do everything you can. I don't think that fits within the direction that the employee is required to give to the union, both to fulfill the grievance, which in this case, it's undisputed, the union had a practice that plaintiffs had followed, that to initiate the grievance process, the employee had to fill out a written grievance form. And I would also point out that previous written grievances had been filed by these individual plaintiffs. And also, the issue that's really before the court was, or now, is the arbitrary prong of the tripartite standard. And there is no, I guess, bad faith of discrimination that was present or found by the district court, although that comes up again in the briefs that are filed before this court. I would just point out the record shows that the union steward who represented the union in most of the actions, the plaintiffs were all social friends. They'd go to each other's house to play pool or have a drink or two. And the record does show by the depositions this even continued after they were terminated by the employer. I'd also like to briefly bring up and just highlight the fact that the employer has filed a Rule 38 motion. And I think our filing of the motion sets forth the points that we believe sanctions are available. There is no authority or anything where the facts that are in dispute here that would sort of give any solace or any basis to the plaintiff to think that he could prevail on appeal. In fact, I think the cases from the Supreme Court on down, the airline pilots versus Neal, which basically said for the union to be guilty of arbitrary contract, there has to be no rational basis for its actions.
So it's your view that each of the plaintiffs didn't even have a colorable basis on which to challenge his termination?
No, I don't think so, no. Especially because they didn't file the written grievance, and they didn't talk to the foreman within 5 days.
They did talk to the foreman.
Well, I don't believe that if somebody has to tell the employee he's discharged, obviously that's the supervisor, somebody who represents the company. The supervisor is required to tell the employee you're terminated. At that point, we have no evidence that the employee said anything. So I would say that to exercise that collective bargaining right the way it was negotiated was the employee then has to pursue and say, look, I want to exercise my grievance and arbitration right. Not, otherwise, that has no meaning. Because the foreman always has to tell the employee you're terminated or any sort of discipline. I mean, otherwise you'd have the employee saying, I wasn't notified. How can I be disciplined if nobody told me? So I think the most common sense reason is the employee's got to come back, and that's what makes sense of that written grievance. So the union knows which employee wants to contest his discipline and the basis for that contention and the basis for the union going forward and doing its investigation as required. If there's no questions, again, the district court got it right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How much time is again? 1 minute.
Your Honor, with all due respect to my opposing counsel, his Rule 38 request is not made in good faith. I respectfully submit it's just a psychological ploy to cast aspersions on the appeal itself. The claim that they should know they can't win the appeal is incredible. And if the basis for a Rule 38 motion is that you are susceptible to it when a district court decision is affirmed, was going to have an incredible chilling effect on appeals. I submit cannot be allowed. The fiduciary duty on the behalf of the union steward must mean something in fact. Otherwise, it's a nullity.
Well, had your people filled out forms before?
They,
for grievances?
They had filled out a form previously for a grievance.
And why didn't they fill them out this time? Because they knew the procedure was to fill out forms.
Well, the union steward didn't give them the forms.
Oh, that's his obligation to give them to him.
I think when they ask him to file a grievance, he has a duty to do that or to make a meeting to get together to fill it out.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take your case under advisement.